महागुरुर्विष्णु गुरुर्देवो महेश्वरः गुरुस्साक्षात् परब्रह्मा तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। ध्यानमूलं गुरोर्मूर्तिः, पूजामूलं गुरोर्पदं, मन्त्रमूलं गुरोर्वाक्यं, मोक्षमूलं गुरोर्कृपा। ॐ सहना भवतु, सहनौ भुनक्तु, सह वीर्यं करवामहै, तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्ति।
Not supposed to suppress that. If you understand, sneeze, blow. When some Shivananda sneezed, it could be heard at least half a mile away.
God is love means.
Oh.
25 words.
Yeah, right.
I think what does the expression God is love? No, I think one of the there's no.
Yeah, there's a screen.
Is there a screen there?
Mm-hmm.
God is love, that love does not mean what we take it to mean, right? It's not the concept called love. It is not, I scratch your back, you scratch mine, and we call it love. It is not a prelude to pleasure. I love you, you love me, and therefore let's have a good time. It's not that. And it is not gratification. Any type of gratification, whether it is physical or mental, psychological, social, whatever it is. And if you eliminate all this, what is love?
But then what is bliss?
But same, God is equal to love is equal to bliss. God is equal to love is equal to bliss. These are three words which refer to the same thing. Three words or three concepts which refer to the same thing looked at from three different points of view.
But it would be something nobody ever has experienced.
Nobody has ever experienced, yes, perhaps. And perhaps yes, perhaps no. Why do we limit that? Why do we there is a lovely expression in one of the Upanishads. After having described what bliss means, it says the entire universe exists matram pujivanti, just by a small one drop from the ocean of that bliss. In other words, our individual experience of love is non-different from that. Just as the individuality is non-different from the being. That's what we have been trying to understand, yeah, all these days. The individuality is non-different from the being. Though, as a limited thing, it apparently separates itself from the being. The ripple, the wave is non-different from the lake, though it seems to have an independent existence or an individuality apart from the lake. My face is covered by skin. It is not as though the face is inside and then the skin is somehow covering it. And therefore, you can safely scrape the skin away without disturbing the face. The face is covering the skin is covering the face. You understand? So that, you know, the plaster is covering the wall. So you can scrape the plaster, put something else there. But when you say the face is covered by the skin, there is a defective expression. The skin is part of that face. Part of the face is also an absurd expression. The skin, the flesh and the bone and the whole lot, that whole thing is called face. So that the waves and the ripples and the water and then the eddies and the pools and what have you, whirlpools and so on, they are all non-different and non-independent of the lake. So, in the same way as the individual is non-different from the totality, the individual love, the personalized love, the limited love, is in essence non-different from the total love. And the individual happiness, limited happiness, is essentially non-different from the bliss that is God. But here there is a limitation. Because of the limitation, my love is directed towards one person. Right? When there is a limitation, this love is directed towards that one person. And therefore somehow there is a feeling that that person is necessary for the love to be experienced. If that person was not there, love is not there in me also. Is that right? If I love that person, if that person is not there, my love is not there in me too. And therefore, we think that that love is dependent upon the appearance or disappearance of that particular person. This is the limitation. Now, when I look at this phenomenon called love, in personal, individual relationship, human relationship, I see that I'm full of love in the presence of this person. I repeat that sentence a few times. I am full of love in the presence of this person. I am full of love in the presence of this person. You know, the merely the accent or the emphasis is shifting. I am full of love in the presence of this person. I am full of love. Oh. Why didn't I say that before? I thought that person was necessary in order to generate this love in me. But I am full of love. Never mind the person or not person. Then I suddenly see that I can be full of love. I am full of love. But then it's changing. When someone else comes, and I am in a different situation, that love is gone, disappears. Then I realize that I am looking for something. And when I look for something else, that love is gone. Aha. So, the love was not in that person, the love was not confined to me, but it was between us. This is the Yoga Vasishtha viewpoint. The love is neither there nor here, it is between. It is a handkerchief. When the ego sense, the subject and the object dissolve, and therefore when there is no limitation, what remains is love, and what remains is bliss, and what remains is being. Neither I can capture it, nor I can invest somebody else with it. There is no subject-object relationship in this love. There is no subject-object relationship in bliss, and there is no subject-object relationship in God. in being. When the subject is dissolved and the object also is dissolved, there is no limitation at all. And that unlimited love, is God. And that unlimited love is bliss. That unlimited happiness is bliss. If I am happy in your company, in your presence, the same argument, then I think my happiness depends upon you. And whenever you appear in front of me, I say, oh, I am very happy in your presence. The same thing, it's the same argument, logic. I am happy in your presence. Then I realize I am happy. The happiness is with me, in me. In your presence is, well, in your presence. Even though in your presence, the happiness is in me, I am happy in your presence. Then one part of the limitation is finished. You are finished. I am happy. And even so, I can be happy in the presence of someone else. So that I am able to say again, I am happy in your presence. Right? So I have now seen that I can be happy in the presence of so many, which means I am happy. But why is it sometimes I'm happy, sometimes I'm not happiness? I'm not happy. There is still a dependence somewhere. There is still a seeking. There is still a longing, a craving for happiness. And it is that makes me look here and there. And when I look here and there, sometimes I look where there is a provocation for this happiness. Sometimes I look where there is a provocation for the opposite of it. And so when that also collapses, between the two there is happiness. Between the two only means when the subject-object relationship collapses, there is happiness everywhere. There is bliss. There is unconditioned happiness. That is the state which is called unconditioned, where there is no conditioning, where there is no limitation. And that which does not suffer limitation is what you call God. I mean, ABC, we have to find the equation. What is called God, not a particular person or a personality or a divine being or non-divine being, all these words we use because we have to use words. Otherwise, the unconditioned being is God. If you don't want to use the word, don't use it. Unconditioned being. And if you want to derive some satisfaction, use the capital B. It's for your own satisfaction, isn't it? It's a code. And you, in order to remind yourself that this is something, this is what I am referring to, you use a code. You may use the code G-O-D, or you may use the code unconditioned being. It doesn't sound very holy, so put a capital B there. What is unconditioned love? That love is divine. A love that is not limited at all by anything whatsoever, any condition whatsoever. And that is what is being experienced in a conditioned and limited way even when we love one another. But because it is limited and because it is conditioned, it suffers from various defects.
Suffers from what?
Various defects, deficiencies. What you call, thesis and antithesis.
You said pain brings about total absorption in divine love.
Oh, what did I say?
which towards the end of this morning.
Pain?
Pain brings about total absorption.
Mm-hmm. Anguish.
Yeah. That's different. Yeah. Uh-huh. That's not pain.
Well, you use pain, though.
Did I use pain?
Yeah.
Shouldn't I?
I would not have written it. It wasn't me.
The pain of separation, probably. I might have said the pain of separation. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
That is the literal translation of the word, viraha.
Uh-huh.
The pain caused by the separation.
I thought maybe it was the pendulum, like pain and love,
no,
and
no,
you had
no,
to come to the center, so
no,
you had
no,
to experience the both sides.
No, no, no. It's merely, I have been in that love, I have experienced that love constantly, almost constantly. Almost constantly is not constantly. Almost constantly. And occasionally there is a diversion from that. In the case of these mystics, they are in constant communion with this love, this cosmic love. And occasionally there is a diversion away from that. And during those moments of diversion, they are filled with anguish. Why did I forget God? That's all. It's the pain of separation, not pain, you know, physical pain or mental pain. It's anguish. I don't think there's a... Is there a single word which can... Anguish? Even anguish can be all sorts of things. This is a peculiar thing. It's a... Viraha, a very peculiar expression. It is normally used in lyrics to denote the condition of the beloved in the absence of the lover. That is its proper use in literature.
Is this comparable, like, with the thing of the great void of the Tibetans, where, like you talked this morning, a comparison of this of like taking a fish out of water. In other words, like taking the mind out of the known into the unknown, and there's that incredible feeling of the great void when you're into something that's beyond your
that
your
is probably
original.
Different. That's a different approach altogether.
So is this, yeah, I see.
That's a quite a different approach altogether. That is the fear of the known or fear of the unknown. Here, I know both of these. The mystic knows what it is to be full of the love of God. And then suddenly, by some quirk of circumstances, he is made to forget. He doesn't remember. He remembers that he had forgotten. That's the way. Huh? He remembers that he had forgotten. And so at that moment, he is filled with a peculiar type of anguish. And even that, unfortunately, like your, you know, the psalm that I reminded you this morning, Eli Eli Lama Sabachthani. Probably the mystic that composed it and sang it was really experiencing this anguish of separation from the love of God. But then now it can be sung in chorus very beautifully. All, you know, there is an organist and then it's all written down. Cool. Huh? And everybody sings very nicely. In the same way, we have a verse which we are supposed to recite right after waking up in the morning, in bed, sort of cursing sleep. Said, "My God, why have I wasted all these 6 hours in sleep? Oh, curse this sleep and curse this forgetfulness of God. Curse this." And people recite this. It's just a beautiful little verse. And so people recite this as we recite Guru Brahma, Guru Vishnu, Guru Deva Maheshwara. mechanically say a serious prayer without any feeling whatsoever. That's what you're supposed to do. Even sleep, they said, oh my God, why was this necessary? Why is it I forgot the purpose of my life in sleep? And this viraha, separation from the beloved, that was dramatized in the life of Krishna. If you study the life of Krishna, it occurs again and again and again when the gopis and those girls who are very fond of him, they curse themselves and they curse the world, they curse everybody who took Krishna away from them. And there's a lovely verse again in the story of Krishna, that when Krishna returned from the fields to the village in the evening, all the gopis would run upstairs into the balcony and keep looking at this Krishna, charming boy, walking into the village. And it seems they used to curse the creator. Do you know what mischief you have done? You've made these eyes blink every time. Every time I blink, I have 1/50th of a second, I've lost the opportunity of seeing Krishna. You don't even know how to build a human body. That is the attitude of the lover.
We talked about faith.
Faith.
Faith. Now, how does faith play if one has experienced the love, let's say the divine love, then does faith play a part in...
That is already faith.
But when the anguish comes, at the time of anguish,
mm-hmm. Right.
Then...
Correct. The anguish itself is there only because of the faith and the hope that it is possible to overcome this and be established in the love of God, yes? It is the experience that creates the faith.
Yeah.
Now, you remember those three, belief, faith and knowledge, or conviction. When you love your child, that is something which you experience without looking for, without striving for, without any effort at all. You love your child. Now, someone has to come and tell you at that time, even this is a manifestation of divine love. Unfortunately, it is circumscribed, it is limited to your child, and if only this limitation can be broken away, and if you could see God Himself, the omnipresent God Himself as your child, and therefore all children as your children, it's possible to break that limitation away and come into divine love. These are words. If you are a mother who is terribly fond of your child, these are just words. And yet, it seems to be logical, it seems to be... And the fellow who says this seems to be a reliable chap, you know, that sort of thing. And so when you hear it in the first instance, you only believe it is possible. There's a belief. Means, you're not sure, there's no faith in it. It's still, well, possible. Then it's possible that some psychologist comes and says, that's nonsense. This is the only natural thing. Your love for your child is the only natural thing. You cannot love somebody else, somebody else's children. It's absurd. Then you drop it. If he is more appealing to your intelligence than the first fellow, you drop it. The belief is easily shaken, dropped. Then once you experience this, the unlimited love, even in a slightly expanded way, then believe, faith arises. It's possible. This is possible. It's possible to shatter this limitation and yet keep this love. And it doesn't mean that I'll cease loving my child, I'll still love this child. It is not as though I have to hate my child in order to love other children. No, no. It is not that I have to divide my love into one, you know. Now that I am loving my child 100%, if I love 100 children, it must be 1% each. It doesn't work that way. I love all the 100 children 100%. Right? When that is realized, then you suddenly discover the possibility of love being unconditioned. You see the possibility of love being unlimited. You experience it yourself. Then faith arises. When that faith arises, once again there is some disturbance. You know, after all, we are all not perfected beings. Sometimes there is a disturbance. You see somebody and you hate that somebody. Then that anguish arises. The anguish arises only because I see the possibility of unconditioned love and yet I have slipped. I have experienced the possibility of unconditioned love and yet I have slipped. I guess you have noticed that we are using the two words love and God and interchangeably, which seems to be the message of that little book we are studying, this Narada Bhakti Sutras. Though continually, what the author obviously meant was what's called God, but it's possible to use it interchangeably.
Is it possible that God could withdraw himself? We talk about this as Leela, the play.
From where?
The world is God's play, Leela.
Yeah.
Now, isn't it possible that why should it always...
I didn't say the world is God's play, the manifestation.
Well, yes. Mm-hmm. Now, couldn't it be possible that instead of saying the mystic or the devotee of the Lord would be amiss somewhere if he cannot completely experience? Couldn't it be that if he is playful, he could withdraw himself from the devotee? And it wouldn't be the devotee's fault or the mystic's fault.
So a remarkable way of looking at it, yes.
That would be disturbing.
It is one of those funny, very significant features of love that it never blames the other person.
No blame.
Whatever it is. In your suggestion, there is, even if it is a playful hide-and-seek business, you are still suggesting that I want you and you are hiding yourself. That thought never occurs to a devotee. If I don't see you, it is my fault. I have missed you somehow. If I don't love you, or if there is no love between us, it is my fault. I have missed somewhere, slipped up somewhere. It doesn't occur to the devotee at all that God might have somehow run away with somebody else and he has left me. It doesn't occur. And as a matter of fact, that is true of even the purer forms of human relationship. The relationship between a lover and a beloved, whether they are husband and wife or otherwise. One who loves the other person really and truly has at no time has any thought, any unworthy thought concerning the other person. Oh, he may not be, he may hate me or he may not like me. That thought doesn't arise at all. It's impossible. And same thing as between a guru and a disciple. If there is that keen guru-disciple relationship, the disciple is incapable of entertaining a thought that my guru may be unfaithful, or he may be unworthy, or he may have slipped up, or he may have abandoned me. That thought doesn't occur at all.
This this concept or this fact of the unlimited love seems to make great fun or great reduce to nothing these so-called exclusive love.